Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You're listening to DNA ID, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family, Missing Persons, Scene of the Crime,
Zodiac Speaking,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
Citizen Detective, and Campus Killings. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
On May 15, 1992, around 3 o'clock p.m., an unnamed contractor was painting a vacant home owned by his grandfather at 3512 Reynolds Street on the southeast side of Fort Wayne, Indiana. He discovered that the dark basement was a flooded mess of 8 to 12 inch deep brackish standing water, mold, and floating debris. And one thing floating in the water grabbed his attention. It was a very dirty pink sneaker. He picked it up and there was something inside it. Foot and ankle bones. This from a May 17, 1992 article in the Journal Gazette. Quote, a contractor found a pink sneaker with an ankle bone in it and asked a neighbor to call police. The neighbor, David Lewis, was visiting his father nearby. Lewis said he wondered whether a body was inside the house when his three-year-old son picked the shoe up and began looking at it. Lewis, who used to work in a morgue, decided to investigate. He said he walked inside the house but didn't find anything. It was then that he walked around outside and looked in the basement window. Lewis said he saw the body, partially covered by a blanket, as he looked through the basement window of the one-story house at 3512 Reynolds Street. End quote. Lewis notified the Allen County Sheriff's Office, and deputies were dispatched to the Reynolds Street location. And there was more from where the foot came from. Police had to pump water out of the basement before removing the body. Floating in the dark water in the basement was a tightly rolled up carpet or heavy moving blanket, the kind used to protect furniture on moving trucks. And opening up the soaked blanket revealed the soaked skeletal remains of a person, really just bones and clothing, and the other sneakered foot. Lewis, the neighbor who, remember, worked in the morgue previously, observed that there was no odor to the remains. That body had been there for a while. The Allen County coroner responded to the scene and viewed the remains, which were found face down in the water rolled up in the carpet or blanket. Dr. Philip O'Shaughnessy stated to the media that based on his on-scene observations and the extreme decomposition, the person could have been in that wet basement for months. There was no decomposition odor and no way to tell how long ago the person had died. There was also no immediate way to determine the cause of death. An initial examination discovered no bullet wounds or bone fractures. Early articles about the disturbing discovery report that the first assumptions were that the remains were of a man. This could be because the sneaker containing the foot was a size 10. But an autopsy on the remains would prove this wrong. The person in the blanket was a woman. She was between 20 and 25 years old with blonde or light brown hair, Coroner O'Shaughnessy told the media. She stood between 4 foot 6 inches and 5 foot 2 inches tall. Her race could not be determined. There was no telling how long she'd been in the basement, but it could have been since sometime in later 1991. Early investigators believed it was possible that the woman had wrapped herself in the carpet or moving blanket to try to stay warm. This was because investigators found evidence that the woman might have constructed a makeshift bed in the basement, Dr. O'Shaughnessy told the Journal Gazette. I don't know how they could tell this with the basement flooded, but there you go. There was no evidence that her death was from anything other than natural causes, exposure or hypothermia. quote, "We saw no fractures, no bullets, no evidence of foul play," Dr. O'Shaughnessy said after the autopsy. He could not rule out strangulation or sharp force trauma that didn't impact bone, but he really didn't know what caused her death. Dr. O'Shaughnessy said, quote, "Unless we have some clues, we'll have an open verdict on the cause of death." So the cause of death was undetermined and remains so to this day. But one fact about the deceased woman that was gleaned from the autopsy: she had been about 26 weeks pregnant when she died. This information was not released to the public at the time. At the autopsy, dental records were collected from the woman's skull. Fingerprints were not obtainable. A sample of the remains was submitted for a tox screen, but it was deemed very likely that any results would be reliable given the state of the remains. Fort Wayne Police Department PIO Sergeant Jim Zamora issued a plea to the public to help investigators identify the dead woman in the basement. The investigators had reviewed all missing persons reports from the area using the dental records or just general descriptions of youngish, blonde females and struck out. So they released some information on what the deceased woman was wearing. These were a very faded gray or light blue extra-large Windcrest jacket, a gray, blue, and white knit t-shirt with white stripes and dark-colored cross stripes, a black bra, white underwear, black sweatpants, and pink Reebok shoes size 10. She was also wearing a gold-colored braided necklace and a gold-colored looped necklace with three star charms. No one called to identify the woman. A week after she was found, on May 21, 1992, she and her baby were buried together in Lindenwood Cemetery, Section 26, with a headstone that read, "Mary Jane Doe." The burial was paid for by local businesses. Investigators had not attempted a facial reconstruction using her skull. The only comparable they retained for future rule-outs were dental records and autopsy photos of her ruined face. When Mary Jane Doe was found, DNA was not yet the standard for identification, and no samples were retained. The known details about Mary Jane Doe were entered into the National Crime Information Center database on June 29, 1992. It was hoped that this might alert other agencies who might have a missing person to the find. That's all they could really hope for, because without fingerprints, DNA, and a recognizable face, the investigators' hands were tied. Attempts to identify the origins of her clothing did not lead anywhere. With a meager case file due to lack of investigative avenues to pursue, Mary Jane Doe remained a Jane Doe for years to come. The Allen County Coroner's Office and the Fort Wayne Police opened the Mary Jane Doe case file on occasion over the years when a report of a missing woman crossed their desks or they received inquiries about whether Mary Jane Doe might be so-and-so. In the mid-2000s, Mary Jane Doe's dental records were compared to dental records from a woman who went missing in 1991 from Florida. This was Teresa Kaiser, but she wasn't Mary Jane Doe. Teresa Kaiser remains missing. Time passed. In August 2016, the Allen County Coroner's Office undertook a new effort to identify Mary Jane Doe, but they quickly realized that the physical evidence was lacking. They were going to have to exhume her in order to obtain new dental radiographs, to conduct a complete autopsy, to complete an anthropology study, and to conduct DNA analysis. By the time the case review was completed, it was winter in Indiana, and they had to wait for the frozen ground to thaw. In the meantime, the coroner's office entered Mary Jane Doe into the National Missing and Unidentified Person System, NAMIS, on November 8, 2016, listing the contact person as Fort Wayne Police Homicide Detective Brian Martin. On March 17, 2017, they dug up Mary Jane Doe. Dr. Scott Wagner, a forensic pathologist, completed an autopsy of the completely skeletal remains. Dr. Craig Nelson, a forensic odontologist, completed a dental study which included radiographs. And students at the University of Indianapolis Anthropology Unit transported the remains to their department for Dr. Krista Latham to complete an anthropology examination of the remains. Dr. Latham collected Mary Jane Doe's left femur and on March 24th submitted it to the University of North Texas Center for Human Identification for DNA testing. Additional skeletal remains were sent to the Indiana State Police Lab for DNA testing as well. The UNT was able to obtain a partial STR DNA profile from the femur material. And on October 19, 2017, the UNT data profile recovered from the femur was entered into the CODIS Unidentified Remains and Missing Persons database to be searched periodically. Unfortunately, there were never any hits for Mary Jane Doe in the system. Now they knew from the DNA analysis that she was Caucasian, but that didn't help them identify her. Some of Mary Jane Doe's teeth and other femur were submitted to Stacy Bozanowski, a forensic scientist with the State Police Crime Lab, on June 18, 2019. Ms. Bozanowski also attempted to obtain a more complete STR DNA profile for Mary Jane Doe, but was unsuccessful. It was now September 2019, and Dr. Latham, the doctor who had examined Mary Jane Doe's skeletal remains after her exhumation, suggested that the investigators table their DNA analysis for the time being. The thinking was that within a few years, technology would likely advance to the point that enhanced DNA analysis for degraded human remains might become possible. The investigators had hit a brick wall. They had done all they could do as far as using the remains. So Namus connected the Fort Wayne authorities with Beth Buchholz, a detective with the Public Safety Department of Longmont, Colorado. Ms. Buchholz was an expert in clay facial reconstruction, and she began the process using Mary Jane Doe's skull on May 1, 2019. On August 5, 2019, photographs of the facial reconstruction were released to the media. The Allen County Coroner's Office issued a media release with the reconstruction images. The information they had about Mary Jane Doe, that she was white, 4'6" to 5'2", a description of her clothing, and that she died from undetermined causes in late 1991 or early 1992. But they also revealed two pieces of information that were new to the public. One was that Mary Jane Doe was approximately 6 months pregnant when she died, and the other was that additional pathology on her skull found healing fractures on her right and left nasal bones. Mary Jane Doe had a healing broken nose. Of course, the question on everyone's minds was the person who got her pregnant the same person who broke her nose, and who was he? The Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette did an interesting article on Detective Beth Buchholz and the process she used to create the clay reconstruction images. This is all a quote from the April 2019 article by Corin Brock. Beth Buchholz provides several professional services in unidentified deceased persons cases, including 3D forensic facial reconstruction and approximation, 2D facial reconstructions, post-mortem photo cleanups, and Photoshop cleanup of clothes and personal items. She also provides 3D scanning and printing of skeletal elements and the reassembly of fragmented craniofacial remains. In Mary Jane Doe's case, Buchholz created a bust in the unidentified woman's likeness to give the public a better idea of what she looked like when alive. I prefer sculpting clay into 3D printed copy of the craniofacial remains, finalized with digital enhancements of the sculpture. I find I get a better likeness using this method because I can see the three-dimensional shape of the facial bones, Buchholz said in an email. So far, Buchholz has assisted with 16 forensic art cases. Although relatively new to the field, Buchholz came into it with a bachelor's degree in biological anthropology and years of experience both in law enforcement and unexplained death investigations, which have helped her understand the challenges of the cases she helped solve through her work. Because it is not possible to create an exact portrait of a person based on the skeletal features alone, she said, the busts might not be an exact replication of what a person looked like in life. However, it can be a step closer in a case with significant deterioration. When photos of the 3D reconstructions are released, the person is more likely to be recognized if information about the person's clothes, personal effects, tattoos, and details about where they were found is included with the images, Buchholz said. In Mary Jane Doe's case, investigators believe the woman was never reported missing. One of the biggest challenges with this work occurs when the unidentified deceased person has not been reported as a missing person. Their name may not appear in missing persons databases, Buchholz said. This can occur if the person has been estranged from their family for some time or has been living a transient lifestyle. In those cases, family may not be looking for them and may not know anything is wrong. As with many other people in her field, Buchholz said her ultimate goal is solving those cases. I find this work extremely rewarding when someone is identified. It's a good feeling to know I may have helped return someone to their family, Buchholz said. It's also rewarding to know, especially in homicide cases, once the person's identity is known, the investigation into their death can finally begin. All that from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. So the images were released in early 2019, and the investigators were hopeful that they would generate tips. I don't know how many tips came in, but any that did led nowhere. By December 15th, 2022, Namus's listing for Mary Jane Doe reflected that there were 7 official rule-outs in her case. Of course, by this time, forensic genealogy had been solving cases for years, and Detective Brian Martin of the Fort Wayne Police Department was intimately familiar with its powers, having used the then brand new technology to solve Fort Wayne's most notorious cold case, the abduction and murder of April Tinsley. I covered that case with input from Detective Martin way back in season 1. And genealogist Lisa Needler, co-founder of Ignite DNA, saw some of the articles in the Fort Wayne media discussing the Mary Jane Doe case. Ms. Needler is from Fort Wayne and based in Indiana. So in April 2023, she contacted the Allen County Coroner's Office, Chief Deputy Coroner Chris Meals, to offer her services. By this time, Meals told WANE on June 16, 2023, quote, "We believe there's enough material to do the sequencing." But there was no money. DNA extractions, sequencing, bioinformatics, none of it is free. Deputy Coroner Meals explained that if Mary Jane Doe were a homicide victim, federal grant money could be tapped for the testing. Here, the cause of death was undetermined, albeit with suspicious circumstances. On June 16, 2023, the Allen County Coroner's Office announced that Lisa Needler of Ignite DNA was seeking to raise the funds, about $4,000, to pay for updated DNA testing of the remains of Mary Jane Doe. She set up a crowdsourced fundraiser on GiveButter.com under the title, "Who Am I? Mystery of the Death of a Young Expectant Mother in Fort Wayne, Indiana." Well, they raised the money in just 3 days. People wanted to help, moved by the story of the young pregnant woman who had now been unidentified for more than 30 years and whose baby never had a chance at life.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
On August 1st, 2023, at the request of the coroner's office, the University of North Texas shipped the DNA extracts taken from Mary Jane Doe's left femur to nonprofit lab Intermountain Forensics for sequencing and bioinformatics. That lab created a SNP profile for Mary Jane Doe based on the DNA extracts. Intermountain Forensics' role was completed on January 13th, 2024, and then Ignite DNA uploaded the SNP profile to GEDmatch and commenced the genealogy analysis. The genealogy in this case took only a couple of days. Ms. Needler said they struck gold when they uploaded the SNP profile to GEDmatch. 2 DNA relatives in that database shared approximately 1,600 and 1,000 centimorgans, respectively, with Mary Jane Doe. There were also several lower-level DNA relatives of varying degrees of cousins. These people were all related to one another, and Ms. Needler suspected that they were on Mary Jane Doe's maternal line, which proved to be correct. They were able to identify a woman they believed was likely Mary Jane Doe's mother. However, she was deceased, had been married numerous times, and had no identifiable connections to Indiana, so things weren't all that clear-cut. On the paternal line, the highest DNA relative shared approximately 200 centimorgans with Mary Jane Doe, a not insignificant amount. Additional relatives on this tree were traced to a most recent common ancestor, and surnames cross-checked with the suspected mother on the other side of Mary Jane Doe's tree until they found the connection between the paternal and maternal trees. On January 16th, Ms. Needler informed the coroner's office that she had identified people whom she suspected were likely Mary Jane Doe's father, mother, and 2 aunts. Her father's name was Robert Bowers Sr. Her mother was Darlene Beasley. Ms. Needler found 1 female child from the Robert-Darlene union who had been adopted out, but that daughter had a death record dated 2022, so she was not Mary Jane Doe. The genealogist just could not locate a name that she could attach to Mary Jane Doe. Once Ms. Needler gave this highly scientific tip to the Fort Wayne authorities that she believed Mary Jane Doe was a daughter of Darlene Beasley and Robert Bowers Sr., it was up to the coroner's office to investigate. Darlene had died in 2013, so Deputy Coroner Chris Meals contacted the woman identified by Ms. Needler as a likely biological aunt of Mary Jane Doe. Her name was Angelina Privett. Angelina confirmed that she had a niece named Tabitha Ann Slane Merlin, who hadn't been seen or heard from in decades. On January 22, 2024, Chris Meals contacted the suspected father, Robert Bowers Sr., still living in the area, and informed him that they may have identified his daughter Tabitha. Meals asked Bowers for a buccal swab for comparison against the DNA of Mary Jane Doe. Robert Bowers spoke to CBS News. He said, quote, "The coroner came to my house, they talked to me, and they told me that she passed away. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe she died like that. I thought she was still alive somewhere," he told the news outlet. The buccal swab from Robert Bowers Sr. was submitted to the Indiana State Police Crime Lab for testing. The ISP Crime Lab had, in July 2023, implemented next-gen sequencing using a Verigen Forensic DNA Signature Prep Kit. Verigen, FYI, owns GEDmatch. Anyway, this tool permits the enhancement of DNA profiles from complex, degraded samples like Mary Jane Doe's. And it also takes into account about 200 SNP markers that can provide ancestry and phenotype information. I know it really sounds like I know what I'm talking about here, but I got all this information from analyst Stacey Bozanovsky at the ISP Crime Lab. There, Mary Jane Doe's DNA was sequenced by the lab using the SIG Prep Kit. A more complete profile was obtained, and then, using the STR profile obtained by that process, kinship testing against the buccal swab profile obtained from Robert Bowers Sr. was performed. On February 12, 2024, the testing confirmed the likelihood of Robert Bowers Sr. being Mary Jane Doe's father was 1 in 7.5 million, considered a very strong likelihood. And Bowers was the father of record of Tabitha Slane Merlin, who had last been seen by her family sometime around 1988. The top DNA relative in GEDmatch proved to be her half-brother, and the second was her half-aunt. So who was Tabitha? Tabitha Ann Slane was born on January 20, 1969, to parents Robert Bowers and Darlene Beasley. 21 Alive did a fantastic article on her, from which much of this information is taken. Tabitha was born in California, but moved to Fort Wayne with her family when she was an infant. As a young child, Tabitha was adopted by her father's sister, her aunt Norma Slane. Norma and her husband Donald raised Tabitha alongside their other children. This was one reason why it was difficult for the genealogist to identify Tabitha by name. She did not reside with her biological mother or father, and she didn't have their last name. Tabitha had two sisters. One, Paula Slane Jones, told 11 Alive her younger sister Tabitha was a happy child who loved to sing and dance. Tabitha was very close to her other sister, Lois Slane Gorney, as the two were less than 12 months apart in age. They shared a room and spent all their time together. Lois spoke to 11 Alive and said, "We loved each other." A friend of the family, Chris Ann Shields, told 11 Alive that she went to camp with the Slane sisters and they often got together for Taco Tuesdays. Tabitha's early childhood, in other words, sounded quite normal. But then, when Tabitha was 14, Norma, whom she called her mother, passed away from cancer. The death apparently hit Tabitha very hard. Norma's sister, Tabitha's aunt Marla Spencer, told 11 Alive that Tabitha had been a happy-go-lucky child, an extremely loving little person who, quote, "would do anything for you." Marla said she didn't have a mean bone in her body. But when Norma died, Tabitha went into a tailspin. Marla told 11 Alive her mom was Tabitha's rock, and after Norma's death, she became troubled. She was strong-willed and rejected efforts of her family and friends to support and guide her. She rebelled, was arrested one time for shoplifting, and got married when she was just 18. That marriage ended, Tabitha drifted from place to place, her family lost track of her, and Tabitha did not tell them where she was or whom she was with. Her close sister Lois started trying to find her sister in 1993 when she began really worrying that Tabitha had not been heard from for years. They knew she was a, quote, "free spirit," and Lois and their friend Chris Ann talked about Tabitha, especially on her birthday and holidays, wondering where she had ended up. They both kind of assumed she would show back up one day. As time advanced, they both spent time looking for Tabitha on the internet, but never found any trace of her there. After years had passed, although Lois hoped and prayed that Tabitha was just living her life out there, she told 11 Alive she started to get a gut feeling her sister was dead. Still, the family never filed a missing person report for Tabitha. And when the Allen County coroner released photos of the clay reconstructions of Mary Jane Doe in 2019, it looked nothing like Tabitha to her family, and did not occur to them that it could be their sister. Now that she knew what happened to Tabitha, Lois Gorney told 11 Alive she didn't understand how her sister ended up in the flooded basement of 3512 Reynolds Street. Did someone wrap her up in that blanket, or did she just wrap herself up to stay warm? Lois questioned. She noted that the house where Tabitha was found was just 7 miles from the family home where she had lived prior to leaving. And the cemetery where Tabitha ended up buried as Mary Jane Doe was a mere 20-minute drive from the home she had left sometime in her teenage years, reportedly to head to Tennessee. Fort Wayne Police Homicide Detective Brian Martin and Chris Meals of the Coroner's Office started investigating the circumstances surrounding Tabitha's death. Tabitha's aunt, Angela Privett, told the investigators Tabitha had married Jerry Merlin on August 8, 1987. She was able to produce the marriage license documenting this life event. Detective Martin and Chris Meals were able to track down this Jerry Merlin. They met with him on February 2, 2024. Jerry told them all about his early marriage to Tabitha. The two were both very young and impulsive and had married quickly. Jerry worked all day for a fencing company and Tabitha stayed home. They butted heads a little because Tabitha would want to go out at night, but Jerry, exhausted from a day of physical labor, didn't. He told the investigators that one day in 1988, the two had a disagreement after work when Tabitha wanted to go to the mall and he did not. He gave her some cash, she left for the mall, and he simply walked out and moved back in with his parents in New Haven. Tabitha never followed him there, although she was driven off his family's property by his father in November of 1989 after she showed up there. The couple never formally dissolved their union. Jerry hadn't seen Tabitha since this 1989 incident, and he didn't know what had happened to her. He did not report her missing either. He assumed she had just moved on. According to Detective Martin, Jerry was cooperative and is not considered a suspect in Tabitha's death, but merely a witness. Tabitha's father, Robert Bauer Sr., told the investigators that he last saw his daughter in 1988 when she said she was leaving for Tennessee with her boyfriend, Travis. This was a whole other angle that had to be investigated. Detective Martin tracked down Travis, whom Tabitha had met in Fort Wayne, and confirmed that the two moved to Memphis together. They both worked, but money was tight and they could not pay the rent on their trailer. So Tabitha returned to Fort Wayne, although not to her family home. Travis never saw her again. Like Jerry, Travis is not suspected in Tabitha's death. A press conference was held by the Fort Wayne and Allen County authorities announcing the identification of Tabitha Merlin. Robert Bowers Sr., his wife Virginia, and Tabitha's brother Robert Bowers Jr. all attended. Allen County Coroner Dr. John Brandenberger said he had been a deputy coroner under Dr. Phil O'Shaughnessy for 5 months when Tabitha's remains were found. So for his entire tenure in the coroner's office, she had been unidentified. He presented a photograph of Tabitha Merlin in life and said, quote, "She has been Mary Jane Doe to us for these years, and now we are able to attach her name and family. So it's an exciting day for us, although couched in the sadness of a loss." He addressed the family, "This is Tabitha's day, and you've been waiting to have a day for her for all this time." Dr. Brandenberger spoke about how unidentified remains cases are the most challenging of the hundreds of cases his office handles each year. He said, as a scientist, it's a wonderful time to be alive with regard to everything that's developed in terms of science and technology. Detective Brian Martin also addressed the media, saying, quote, "The work that was done in this case and the tenacity that was shown by the coroner's office, the state police lab, and everyone involved is amazing. It obviously gives us hope in all the other missing persons cases, unidentified cases, and cold case homicides," end quote. Lisa Needler spoke about the forensic genealogy she had performed and how that analysis located Mary Jane Doe's parents within hours. Robert Bowers Jr. spoke with a reporter from WFFT and held up Tabitha's photo for the camera. "This is her. This is my sister." Of her being given her name back, he said, "This is good, but we need to find out what happened." "We do indeed. Tabitha was approximately 23 years old when she died sometime between late 1991 and early 1992. Her birthday's in January, so her exact age is uncertain. She was pregnant, a very dangerous time for women, and her nose had recently been broken. Detective Martin told me that based on the photos of the crime scene and the recovered evidence, he does not believe Tabitha rolled herself up in that large, heavy carpet or blanket that she was found floating inside. Her death, in his seasoned opinion, is highly suspicious. Detective Martin has conducted 6 to 8 interviews with people who knew Tabitha, trying to reconstruct her movements and find out who she might have been spending time with and how she ended up in the basement of that house. But at this time, the investigation has sort of run its course. Of course, I had to ask him the million-dollar question. Is DNA testing being conducted on the fetal remains of Tabitha's child? Detective Martin told me they are exploring that very possibility. The baby's bones are tiny and degraded, so it's unclear whether they'll be able to obtain results. But if they are able to obtain DNA from the fetal skeleton and use that to identify the baby's father, I have to believe that will be a first. It could take years, so we'll have to be patient. In the meantime, the investigation into Tabitha's death is continuing, and if you have any information about Tabitha's disappearance or death, please call the Fort Wayne Police Department Detective Bureau at 260-427-1201 or Crime Stoppers at 260-436-7867. While Tabitha's baby's remains are in the possession of the Allen County investigators, Tabitha herself has been returned to her family. If you'd like to donate to the family's GoFundMe seeking funds to inter Tabitha in a place of the family's choosing with a headstone, please go to www.gofundme.com/f/tabitha/slain/donate. Recently, I let listeners know about a new benefit available to them called an Abjack Insider subscription that's available through Apple Podcasts. An Abjack Insider subscription will give listeners ad-free access to every bit of DNA ID content published, both past episodes and future episodes. It will also give you benefits like early access and bonus content. Head over to Apple Podcasts and click on the DNA ID show page or the Abjack Entertainment channel to start a free trial. Thanks for listening to this episode of DNA ID. If you'd like to listen to the show ad-free and help support the show in the process, please head over to patreon.com/DNAID. And if you're interested in some fun DNA ID merch, visit the store at customizedgirl.com/s/DNAID podcast. To contact the show, please email us at DNAIDpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on social media at DNAID Podcast on Instagram, at DNAID Podcast on Twitter, or on Facebook at facebook.com/DNAIDpodcast. Finally, if you want to visit our website, go to DNAIDpodcast.com. You'll be able to get all the episodes of the show, leave comments on episodes that I can respond to, and you can even leave voicemails. You'll get all the latest news about the show and important updates, find links to our social media, merch, and a lot more. It's really your one-stop shop for everything DNA ID. DNA ID is written, researched, and hosted by me, Jessica Betancourt. It's produced by me and Mike Morford of Abjack Entertainment. Music by Connor Betancourt. Check out our other collaborative podcasts, Scene of the Crime, Missing Persons, and Beyond Bizarre True Crime.